like to thank Rabbi Wiederblech for coming, braving the elements, for giving us a para.
Okay, thank you all for coming. I'd like to thank Ben Roski for arranging this, and it's really a pleasure to be here with you and discuss this most interesting and, I guess, to some degree, a sensitive issue. Now, first of all, this is not meant to be a comprehensive discussion of this issue. There are many aspects of the topic that we're not going to be able to address. However, let's begin with a consideration of the Maharal. So the Maharal deals with this question, namely contradictions or seeming contradictions between Torah and science, primarily in his Be'er HaGola, which is a defense of Chazal against the critiques or attacks that were common in that day. In a sense, much hasn't changed in 500 years. Many of the same issues that were being raised then continue to be raised. Of course, the specifics have changed. But the general question, to some degree, remains very much the same. However, we're not going to begin tonight in the Be'er HaGola. Rather, I thought we would start with a discussion in the Hakdama to the Gvuras Hashem. The Gvuras Hashem in his Maharal Sefer on the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim and Pesach. That's on the right column of page 1. And just by means of an introduction, Maharal here is responding to philosophers who attempt to minimize nisim. Now, why would someone want to minimize a nis? And here, when we say someone, we mean someone who believes in the Torah. So why would someone wish to minimize a nis? So there are some Rishonim, for example, the Rambam, who understand that, generally speaking, the laws of nature are operative. And moreover, these laws are permanent. The Rambam learns this, derives this from a number of psukim, among them Chok Nasan Velo Yavor, which means that the laws of nature will continue forever. This relates to his position that even in messianic times, there will not be a deviation in the laws of nature. This is associated with the view of Shmuel that says, Ein bein olam hazel yimos ha-mashiach ha-lashibud malchios bilvad, which means to say that there aren't going to be changes in Teva. And there were those that also did so. Now, why does the Rambam say this is true? Among other things, the Rambam says that there are philosophical reasons for this. If change in Teva, change in nature, would imply some sort of deficiency that requires a correction, and therefore, he says, there's no correction needed. One of the thinkers that perhaps goes to the furthest extreme in this respect is the Ralbag. Among other things, I became familiar with the Ralbag because my brother-in-law, Menachem's brother, Yitzchak, Rabbi Dayan Yitzchak Grossman, is very fond of the Ralbag. And the Ralbag goes ahead and believes that while nisim are possible in our world, nisim are impossible in the celestial realm. Meaning to say that he believes in Kriyas Yamsuf, he believes in the 10 plagues, all of these were nisim. Nisim meaning to say temporary deviations from the laws of nature. However, for reasons that pertain to his Aristotelian conception of the universe, he believed that nisim were impossible in the celestial realm. We need not go into the details as to why he felt that way, because it relates to a perspective on the universe that nobody actually thinks is true anymore. Which, by the way, does point to an important issue to remember whenever we're discussing matters of Torah and science, which is that science does change, evolve. Very frequently, the theories that people are sure about are amended and corrected 10, 20, 30, 100 years later. But be that as it may, The Ralbag felt that Nisim were impossible in the celestial realm. Now, that's a theory that works fine with things like Kriyas Yamsuf, but there are two Nisim in particular that he has to deal with which are highly problematic for his theory. One is the Nes of Shemesh B'Givon Dom, the story in the book of Yehoshua, where the sun stood still to allow the Jewish people to pursue the enemies. And the second is the story with Yechezkel and Yeshayahu at the end of Sefer Malachim, where again the retrogression of the sun for a certain period of time. How does the Ralbag explain this? So as I said, this is a big problem for the Ralbag, and in his commentary on Nevi'im, as well as in his Sefer Milchamos Hashem, it's in Book 6, Part 2, Chapter 12, he comes up with, we'll say, rather creative exegesis, rather creative reading of the psukim, so as to explain and interpret the psukim in such a way that it doesn't contradict his theory. So, for example, when it comes to the Sefer, the story of Chizkiyahu and Yeshayahu, he says that the sun didn't move, rather the shadow moved. So the miracle was on this world. Again, he's not denying miracles. The miracle was on this world, but it wasn't in the celestial realm. It wasn't in outer space, as it were. So it's about this Ralbag that the Maharal is critiquing. And that's the introduction to the text that we're going to begin with. Now, Maharal wasn't the first to critique Ralbag about this. The Rivash is a tshuva in which he prohibits more or less the study of philosophy. He's not too keen about the study of science either, though he reluctantly allows that, but he prohibits the study of philosophy. And among the things that he says is that even though there were great people who studied philosophy, like the Rambam, look at what happened to brilliant minds like the Ralbag, who were basically led astray by the teachings of Aristotle, to the point that he says such a ridiculous pshat that it's impossible for there to be miracles in the celestial realm. So that is the Rivash's critique. And with that, we'll begin with the Maharal. So the Maharal writes that, first of all, it doesn't make sense to try to limit miracles, because if you're going to hold of those who think miracles are impossible, like Aristotle, then you shouldn't minimize miracles, you should deny miracles. If you accept the Aristotelian perspective on the universe, which was quite dominant at the time, which asserted not just the eternity of matter, but also the impossibility of there being any type of divine intervention, that the universe existed independently and therefore could not be affected by God. Aristotle did believe that there was God, but God could not affect the universe. So if you're going to deny miracles, then deny miracles. But once you're not going to deny miracles, once you're going to believe that there are miracles, then why minimize and why limit miracles? And therefore, once you reject Aristotle, he thinks that the tendency to try to minimize them doesn't make much sense. That's his first objection. The second objection is that the psukim don't sound like your interpretation, and therefore there's no reason to force the psukim into a very awkward reading when the only motivating factor is science, because we should try our best to understand the psukim and chazal as they appear without trying to squeeze your scientific theories into them. However, interestingly enough, the Maharal doesn't just say, okay, so therefore there was a miracle, the sun stopped, and that's it. That's the end of the story. Instead, the Maharal offers a reading of the psukim which is quite fascinating. The Maharal writes, so, Amnam tsarich iyun, im nase neis zeh, l'chol ha'olam, o lo nase neis zeh, rak be'ofek ahu. Meaning to say, the sun certainly stood still. However, did it stand still everywhere, or just for the Jewish people in Eretz Yisrael? Now, first glance, this question seems highly unreasonable. How could the sun stand still and continue to move? It's the same sun that you look at when you're in the United States of America as it is in the other part of the world, in Israel and the like. So what does it mean when he says, perhaps it only stood still in one place? He explains, Ki yesh lomar, ki liyehoshua v'Yisrael ba'ofek hahu, haya amidas ha-shemesh, ulechol ha'olam lo amda ha-shemesh. V'zeh yoser pel, if anything, this is a greater miracle. Mora al-buras ha-shem yisparach v'nifla'osa. V'im yomar, eich yitachein davar zeh b'tziur, how is that possible that it could be both standing still and moving simultaneously? Perhaps the sun will continue moving as it is through its normal pattern, but at the same time it will also stand still from the perspective of a miracle. It's possible for two contradictory things to happen simultaneously with respect to two different planes or two different realities. Nature is one plane, one reality, and miraculous intervention is another. Ki en safek ki mala tanes habilti tivi hu yoser b'ma'ala u'b'medrega min hateva. U'mipnei shem shtei madregos mischalfos hinei haisa shemesh b'shnei b'chinos kifi chilof ha-madregos teilech mitzad hateva v'ta'amod b'tzad bilti tivi. Ki kishem shiroi shetelech mitzad ha-teva, kach yesh bechina tzichlis, shebeemtza ha-shamayim yesh la-amida. So, on one perspective, the sun continued to move. This might explain why there are no, as far as I know, recordings. Nobody mentioned that the sun stopped at this time. Now again, that question isn't what's motivating the Maral, but it is interesting. Rather, from one perspective, the sun continued to move, and from another perspective, namely the miraculous perspective, it stood still. Kemoshis bayar, v'hu b'china sichlis. So, from the sichli perspective, it stopped. Ve'en zativi, ulekach hayala amida b'madrega bilti tivit. Gam liyoshua ve'amo shehayu tzrichim el hanes bilti teva haisa amida ulishar ha'olam en tzrichim l'nes hayalahem minag hativi. So then he said, the question that we're all wondering, V'al yikshel lecha, hey'ach davar zeh efshar letzayer, sh'im nomar, sh'amda shemesh liyoshua bilvad, l'chol olam ha'ocha, hinei shaka liyolam min ha'ofek, liyoshua haisa shemesh al ha'ofek, v'davar zeh eich efshar. What happened? So it's sunset for some people and not for others? Davar zeh lo kasha l'mi shemevin divrei chachamim. Ki zeh haya liyoshua b'inyan nisi mitzad ha'madrega bilti tivit. She'en davar ze inyan v'shaychus el ha-teva. V'haya la'amida al ha-ofek mitzad ha-bilti tivi, v'ashkia mitzad ha-nahagas ha-teva v'anisim en l'davar b'hem v'lamod aleyem mitzad ha-teva. Ki hem nisim yotzi mitzad ha-shalolam, v'hine chachamim ha-medabim mitzad ha-teva hu davar havai. Ki klal advarim ki masa nisim hu v'en l'amod aleyem mitzad ha-teva. Essentially what he's saying is that at this point in time, the miracle allowed the Jewish people to tap into some type of different reality, different plane of existence, in which the sun stood still, and the rest of the world that was unable to tap into this deeper spiritual reality, for them, the sun continued to move. Now this relates to another interesting question, one that we will not address tonight, which is the question of whether God is bound by the laws of logic. Also a favorite of Yitzchak. The question of, is it possible for God to do something that's logically impossible? Seemingly, the Maral says that's not a problem. And in a sense, he magnifies the miracle by saying if the sun both stood still and moved simultaneously. But at the same time, he allows for a very different perspective about how to view the world. Let's skip to the next bolded section. Amru asara nisim nasu lavosenu beis hamikdash ve'achad mehem omdim tzfufim u'mishtachavim revachim. The Maral then goes ahead and shows that there are many miracles depicted by Chazal which seem to be portraying this very same duality, dichotomy, contradiction. One example. The Beis HaMikdash was of limited space. During the time of Aliyas HaRegel, all the Jewish people would pack in, or during the Yom Noraim, and an amazing thing happened. When everybody was standing, they were all smushed together, and yet when it came time to bow, there was room for everybody to bow. Now, if we ask, how did this miracle take place? So before seeing this Maral, I would have said, I guess, you'd either have to say people shrunk, or the area expanded. So what he's suggesting is no, that at the time of a miracle, the people, the participants that experienced the miracle somehow or another tap into a reality in which, in the case of Yoshua, is above time, in this case is above space. They weren't bound by the limitations of space or time and the like. And this allowed for the possibility of bowing when there was no room. You don't have to say the people shrunk. You don't have to say that the area expanded. Rather, they, for a certain period of time, were able to tap into a reality where they were not bound by the limitations of space or time or the like. However you want to put it. He doesn't use those terms, but something along those lines. Yes?
In the same sense, are we able to say that when the sun stops, excuse me, it's mystically just a day, like 5 seconds every 1 second, because then there's someone else to catch up?
Right. So euphemisms or allegories or the like is what the Maharal is rejecting. In other words, there were those who tried to allegorize certain portions of the Torah due to questions dealing with science. That's not what the Maral is doing. The Maral is saying something else. He's saying that for them, time moved slower or stopped, but it didn't stop for everyone else. So he doesn't tell you how exactly this happened, and he doesn't even know probably how exactly it happened. He simply says that is the reality. And, as I said, there are many many examples where perhaps one might want to say this in Chazal. One example is, if you just look at the second source, the Gemara in Megillah, this is on the left column, Davar zeh misoros b'yadeinu mi'avoseinu, makom aron eino min haminyan. What does that mean? So according to the Maral, what that means is that in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, limitations based off of space were not applicable. So this Maral is quite radical and revolutionary, and it's something that we have a very difficult time relating to, of course, because we live in a world which is bound by place, space and time, and the reality that we perceive is one which is certainly limited by the constrictions of space and time. However, I saw a fascinating idea in the work The Halachic Mind, which is an essay on Jewish tradition and modern thought. It's hard to call it an essay. It's really a book by the Rav. This book by the Rav is one of the most difficult books that he wrote, and I certainly admit I don't understand every part of it. However, he begins the work with a fascinating statement. This is in the left column of page 1. It would be difficult to distinguish any epoch in the history of philosophy more amenable to the mediating homo religiosus than that of today. Remarkable thing. This was written originally in 1944. And the Rav is saying something that I think people generally assume is the opposite of the truth. We all assume that the big problems with religion and science are the issues of the 20th century. Issues like evolution, dinosaur bones, evidence against the Bible, whatever particular questions bother people today. And what the Rav is saying, quite remarkably, is that in fact the opposite is the case. The 20th century is the century that it is the easiest to mediate, to resolve, to deal with questions of science and Torah. Why would that be? What makes our epoch different? Because philosophy remained the satellite of science until the beginning of the 20th century. What does he mean? So, exactly, and just to add to that a little bit, for centuries, science and philosophy walked hand in hand with the claim that there is a single way to view the universe. And therefore, religion either had to adopt to that means, that perspective of the universe, or basically assert that religion is irrational and ignores science. And this was true with the Aristotelian conception of the universe and the Newtonian conception of the universe. And the Rav says that this is no longer true with the ideas of relativity, the ideas of quantum physics. So we no longer believe that there's a single, unified, simple way to view the universe. Now, I have to admit at this point that I'm way over my head. I'm not a physicist, and I don't. I'm not speaking from a vast, from even minimal scientific understanding, only from what I've read on this topic. However, let's consider an example. There is a fascinating concept which is referred to several times in the Gemara, "Elu v'elu divrei Elokim chayim," which means that even though you have a dispute, whether it's between Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, or Rabbi Yonasan and Rabbi Abiyasar, that both perspectives are true. Now, the Gemara tells us that this is true even when the two perspectives seem to be mutually exclusive, meaning to say that even the participants in the debate could not conceive of how it was possible that both their position is correct and the alternative position is correct. For example, the Gemara discusses in Maseches Gittin the exact thing that the husband got angry at his wife, or his Pilagesh, in the story of Pilagesh Begiva. Was it Nima Matzalah, or is Vuv Matzalah? We need not get into the details. It was a machlokas between Rabbi Avyasar and Rabbi Yonasan, and both of them thought that their position was correct, the alternative position was wrong. But not only that, they thought that their position, the two positions, were mutually exclusive. They were incompatible. And the Gemara goes ahead and says, no, Elu v'elu divrei Elokim chayim, and they're both correct. And the Gemara explains how it is that they're both correct. Now, perhaps another time we could discuss the idea of Elu v'elu. This is a fascinating concept in its own right. But for now, I just want to share a perspective on this that I saw, interestingly enough. I first saw this in the Ale Shur, Rivoldi, and then I saw Dr. Lamb makes the same point. He says that an analogy for Elu v'elu divrei Elokim chayim is wave-particle duality. In what sense? In the following sense, if an electron has displays properties of both a wave and a particle. Now, waves and particles act in different ways, and they're mutually exclusive. If something acts like a wave, seemingly not can't be a particle. If it's a particle, it's not a wave. And yet, depending on how you look at it and the like, it has properties both of a wave and a particle. Now, how is that possible? Somehow or another, both are true. Both are true simultaneously. The resolution is, we don't know, but they're still both true. In other words, we are more comfortable with the idea of impossible things, contradictory things, being simultaneously true. And with that, the Rav says, we can go ahead and look at contradictions between science and religion in a whole new perspective. They're both true, They're simultaneously true. The resolution is something that we may not be able to understand. But as opposed to all centuries before the current one, where we couldn't say both are true, it's a contradiction, and still basically carry the mantle of rationality, now we could say that. And this is what the Rav called epistemological pluralism. Epistemology is the study of how we know things, and he said pluralism is the notion that two things can both be right. And take a look at this quote on the next quote. Again, still source 3. Epistemological pluralism has not abandoned the realm of logic. It says only that reason itself leads the physicist, psychologist, philosopher, and homo religiosus, that means ish hadas, the religious person, to a pluralism of viewpoints. The heterogeneity of knowledge, however, is not based upon a manifold of methods employed by theoreticians, but upon the plurality of the objective orders they encounter. And summarizing this book, as I said, it's a particularly hard book, but I saw there's a nice article by Dr. William Kohlbrenner, who essentially summarizes a number of the major themes of halachic mind. He writes, "The Newtonian philosopher posited the existence of a universe which was rationally quantifiable and objectively given. The quantum physicist, by contrast, argued against scientific objectivity. Atomic and subatomic phenomena did not conform to the Newtonian's rationalist map. There was uncertainty, and even worse, quantum physics placed the ostensible objectivity of the scientific observation in doubt. There was no such thing as the innocent observer standing outside or above an ostensibly pure objective reality. The scientist helped to create his experimental reality. There was no such thing as purely objective date. Quantum physics rescued the philosopher of religion from his slavish attachment to the objective Newtonian science. Essentially, quantum physics showed that there was no rationally ordered objective world, and also there was no methodological objectivity. And this totally changed our perspective when it comes to dealing with issues of science. This might be what the Rav meant in another famous statement. This one is from The Lonely Man of Faith, a work which is much more accessible to the typical reader, in which he writes the following. I've never been seriously troubled by the problem of the biblical doctrine of creation vis-a-vis the scientific story of evolution at both the cosmic and the organic levels. Nor have I been perturbed by the confrontation of the mechanistic interpretation of the human mind with the biblical spiritual concept of man. I have not been perplexed by the impossibility of fitting the mystery of revelation into the framework of historical empiricism." The book gets a little easier. Moreover, I have not even been troubled by the theories of biblical criticism which contradict the very foundations upon which the sanctity and integrity of the scriptures rest. And Rav says, basically, two of the problems which people find most problematic have never really troubled me. One of them is the issue of biblical criticism. Now, in terms of that issue, the Rav actually deals with this in this work, not in an overt way, but in his descriptions of the distinction between Adam 1 and Adam 2, he basically accepts all of the diukim that biblical critics made and argues for a unified reading in which the two creation narratives refer to two different perspectives on the universe, and there is a different perspective of Adam 1 and Adam 2, and anyone who reads that is just overwhelmed by its brilliance. And that type of model is something that is very effective in terms of dealing with issues of biblical criticism, to show basically that the critiques of biblical criticism largely have to do with the assumption that there was a clumsy redactor who was merging together all sorts of texts. And if you acknowledge the possibility even of a complex work, so then those problems go away. So he tells you how he's going to deal with that. But he doesn't tell you how he deals with the issue of science and why it is that this doesn't bother him. And the answer, I think, is, among other things, based off of his theory of epistemological pluralism. Now, the rest of the book of Lonely Man of Faith deals with a problem which did bother him. Ironically enough, the problem that bothered him is not necessarily the problem that bothers the people that are bothered by problems anymore, but I'll just read it. However, while the theoretical oppositions and dichotomies have never tormented my thought, I could not shake off the disquieting feeling that the practical role of the man of faith within the modern society is a very difficult, indeed a paradoxical one. So that's the topic of that book. But again, here you have the Rav telling you he's not bothered by the issues of science. And this is largely because of what we explained, namely the theory of epistemological pluralism. The idea that both the perspective of religion and the perspective of science are two correct ways of viewing the same reality. They reflect two different perspectives, and to go ahead and to try to resolve the contradictions is really the wrong approach. It's like trying to be miyashev the stira between electrons being a wave and electrons being a particle. Now, to be sure, many scientists are working on that. There are many physicists working on a unified theory. But others are happy saying, in a chanami, to say it in yeshivish, we have a stira, but that's not a problem. They could both be true. Well, the same thing when it comes to science. And therefore, to look at it as a clash in need of resolution is really the wrong perspective. This idea has been adapted by different thinkers, and they put it in different ways. Perhaps we'll have a chance to look at some of the writings of Rav Kook on page 3 going on to page 4, but for now, I'll just summarize the way he puts it, which is essentially that the Torah is coming to teach us one perspective. The purpose of the Torah is to teach us how to be good people, how to connect to Hashem, how to live proper lives, and that's one agenda. And the purpose of science is something else. It's to describe the observable universe. And because they have two different purposes and agendas, they will describe the same thing in different ways. And therefore, you shouldn't really be bothered by contradictions, because they're dealing with two different issues, two different planes. It's like asking a contradiction between Shakespeare and science. These are two different realms, and they're attempting to do two different things. And therefore, there's really no need for resolution. So that is essentially the idea of the Rav and the idea of Rav Kook. Each one says it in its own language. But really, as we saw before, this is rooted in the idea that we started with the Maharal. What was the Maharal saying? The Maharal was saying this exact point. There's a way to describe it using 20th century science that the Maharal didn't have available to him, but that's what he was saying. He's saying there's the realm of Teva, in which the sun continued to move, and there's the realm of the spiritual, or what he calls the Sichli, in which the sun stopped. With this, perhaps we could explain so many Ma'amarim in Chazal. Just to take a couple more, I don't want to give too many examples, because I want to move on to the Maharal's second point. But, for example, when the Torah and Chazal describe Matan Torah and the Aseres HaDibros, we're told Zachar V'Shamer B'Dibur Echad, we're told that the entire Aseres HaDibros were stated in one moment, Masha'ein HaPeh Yachal Omro V'Ein HaOzen Yachal Yishmoa. Essentially, that the giving of the Torah took place outside of time. This, by the way, might relate to why it is that Matan Torah isn't mentioned in any of the histories in Tanakh. It might relate to why we don't even know when it took place. It's debated in the Gemara. It might relate to a lot of things. This also might be what it means, Ra'u es ha-kolos. They were able to see the sounds, because sound is something that takes place within time. There's no meaning to a single unit. Syllables make words, words make sentences, sentences make paragraphs, and then you have meaning. seeing is something that takes place in an instant. That's why we could say pictures take a lot, pictures mean 1,000 words. Ro'es hakolos is a merging of those two things. There's really many more examples of this idea where we find in Chazal this notion that miracles take place outside of space, outside of time. The idea of the Maral, and really one which I think works very nicely in the idea presented by the Rav. The next text that we're going to see from the Maharal is from the Sefer Ber HaGolah. It's on page 2, source 6. Hatluna Hashishis, so this is the sixth critique that people have against Chazal. Be'amram ki hayana ela mehem chachma hanoshis, heim hachachmos asher lefi hasechel hanoshi. The claim basically that Chazal were unaware of science and didn't understand science and therefore made all sorts of mistakes. And this is basically a means of explaining certain midrashim and certain mamarim, because we shouldn't accept them. Basically, they were based off of mistakes in science and the like. So again, this was a critique that was made at the time. V'davar zeh, im hayakach, hu mora zeh chisan hayadiyah v'achakam in ha'emes. V'davar zeh hefach mima shehizhiru alav chachamim, v'isa be'perak chavis, amor l'chachma ha'chosihi. We won't have a chance to read it inside, but basically what he says over here is that Chazal were very much in favor of saying that which they're sure about, that which is true, not making a mistake. Amor l'chachma chosihi is understood by the Gemara to say that a person should only say that which they're aware of, that which they're knowledgeable of. And therefore, if Chazal said certain things and it was based off of ignorance, so they would be violating their own principles. So skip to the left column. V'achachmos she'amru aleihem she'dibru bahem zaras hi achachma tivis v'achachma le'mudis. V'kvar nizbar l'cha ki kol she'hevi'um l'davar zeh l'achshov al chachamim kach zehu ma she'matzu b'dvarim she'nasnu sibos l'dvarim tivim she'nishavim ba'olam. So what caused people to say, to conclude, that the Chachamim were ignorant in matters of science? Essentially, they saw Chazal and Midrashim and Agadic statements giving reasons for physical phenomena which are not the correct reason, which contradict science. Aval ein ha'emes kach klal, ki lo ba'u chachamim ledaber min asiba hativis. The agenda of the chachamim was not to talk about physical reality, the laws of science. The Gemara, the Midrashim, are not intended to be a scientific work. Ki katon ufachos hasiba hativis, ki daber ze yeus l'chachmei hateva. That would be the appropriate realm for scientists. Oh, lirofim, lo l'chachamim. Scientists, doctors, their job is to go ahead and explain the physical world using the laws of science. Aval hamzal dibru min asiba shemechayev hateva. So what then is the interest of Chazal? It's to look for the reason behind the science, behind the physical reality, to look for the deeper reality, not the physical cause, not the scientific cause, but the spiritual cause. So when Chazal say that, let's take the example of eclipses, that eclipses happen for such and such reason, or when the Torah says that rainbows happen for such and such reason, the Torah and Chazal are not attempting to give a physical explanation, a scientific explanation. The scientific explanation might be true, but that is not the agenda of the Chachamim. Rather, their agenda is to give a spiritual explanation for this physical concept. V'amachish davar zeh machish amun v'atora. K'moshi z'bar l'mala, shamra Torah osa kasha. So let's take a look at an example. The description in Parshas Noach of the reason for the rainbow. V'ra'isa v'ri'isiha l'skor bris olam. So we know, of course, scientists gave a naturalistic explanation for the rainbow. It relates to the refraction of light, etc. Essentially, the raindrops are prism. As everyone knows who studies a little bit of science, and the Raral was quite well aware of science. Now is not the time to discuss the history of Maral, but there is some interesting stories in that realm as well. Avala dava hukach. Shehasiba shernasna hatola hu hasiba, shelochol davar yeshiba tivis, mechayeva so, thou osa siba tivis, yeshiba lokis. So certain, everything, he says, has a natural reason, and that natural reason is correct. But why is it that that natural reason is true? There's also a deeper godly reason, a spiritual reason. Vehu sibas hasiba, umize dibru chachamim. Kila Adam el Tsuraso Mispari Varav Yesh Sibativis. Again, another example. Chazal talk about the Taryag Mitzvos Ramachi Varim Shesagidim. Of course there are scientific explanations, and they are true on the realm of science, but not in the realm of the Siba Elokis. Shall Siba Sadava Amar Vaivar Elokim Es Adam Bitzelem Elokim Barao So. So essentially, to take again his rainbow example, and he gives many examples in this chapter, but the rainbow example. Someone who reads the Torah superficially will be bothered by a problem. They'll read Parshas Noach. Parshas Noach tells us that rainbows relate to sin and HaKadosh Baruch Hu's promise not to destroy the world again and the like. And he'll say, oh no, we have a stira, because I learned in science class that rainbows relate to refraction, and now the Torah tells me that rainbows relate to sin and promises. And the Maharal is telling us that that is a very superficial and incorrect way to view the Torah's reason. The Torah is not denying the idea of refraction. The Torah instead is giving us the deeper reason for this physical manifestation. And the same is true with respect to the Gemara's interpretations of eclipses and the like. It's interesting, and we don't have time to go through it, but the Ramban, which is in source 7, also deals with this issue. The Ramban writes that when you read the Torah initially, it sounds like the reason for rainbows has to do with the Haftacha Kadosh Baruch Hu gave post Mabul, and he says V'anachnu al korchenu namin l'divrei hayavanim. That's the underlying text. Now this is an important line, because we know the Ramban was not always such a big fan of those who he calls the Yevanim Ha'arurim, the accursed Greek scientists and philosophers and the like. But he says that we can't accept the initial understanding of the Psukim, because we have to accept al-Korchenu, that which science has proven, namely that rainbows relate to refraction. In other words, we're not going to go ahead and say that this was a new phenomenon that only began after the flood. Rather, this was actually something that always took place. It was not new. So what does it mean? It means a new understanding of this possibility. Now, to be sure, and this relates to a really important issue, which we're not going to do tonight, but it relates to the question of how far we could go in terms of rereading and reinterpreting Torah in light of science. On the one hand, the Ramban here says that we do consider science. On the other hand, it's clear from his continuation that he's considering science because he thinks it's a plausible and, in fact, perhaps preferable reading of the text. But again, going back to the Maharal is saying that there's really something much deeper going on here, because there's no contradiction. Scientists and the scientific explanation of the rainbow is dealing with a very different type of explanation than that which interests the Torah. When we ask why something took place, why can mean many different things and could be dealt with on many different levels, and the level of the Torah is different than that of science. So there's very much works very nicely with the idea that he said earlier. This.
How does this relate to the something where Chazal tell you how something works? Like the example that's very popular is the, let's say, spontaneous generation of lice or something like that, where it's not, where it's giving you some sort of a Torah-based thing that...
Okay, yeah, that's an excellent question. And how do you deal... That's especially problematic because it has halachic implications. Are you allowed to kill lice on Shabbos? Are you not allowed to kill lice on Shabbos? And the approach that we're giving and that the Maharal presents over here will not always help you answer questions of that sort. Meaning to say, in that case, you have to figure out, did Chazal literally mean that there's spontaneous generation? Well, it certainly seems to be the case. Have scientists proven that there is no such thing as spontaneous generation? That also seemingly seems to be the case. Well, then how does one resolve that? And I think that you're correct that this type of approach, thank you so much, that this type of approach really will not necessarily help you answer that question. It might, but it might not, especially because in this case, there's a very practical question. Not so practical, we don't kill lice too frequently, but at least theoretically, there are halachal mice and nafkaminas. Are you allowed to kill that lice, that louse, or not? There have been a number of approaches to dealing with that question, which I think are compatible with the Maharal. One possibility is that Chazal were in fact making a mistake when it came to science, their scientific conclusions concerning spontaneous generation were based off of the accepted scientific understanding of the time. Certainly, there were Rishonim that made that assumption with respect to certain passages in the Gemara. Even the Rashba, for example, says that was the case with respect to the cures and refuos in Perek Misha Chazu and Gittin. And in that case, well, what about nowadays? How does that change? So one possibility is to say, well, now that we see that they're in error, it's going to be usher to kill lice. That possibility is considered, among other things, in the Sefer Pachad Yitzchak, not Rav Huttner's, but Rav Lamporti's. There are other approaches. Rav Dessler and others have suggested that what interests halacha is that which is visible to the naked eye, and therefore, since the birth of the nitz seems to be spontaneous, so therefore one would still be allowed to kill them, and there are many aspects in halacha which we are only concerned with that which the eye can see, like the squareness of your tefillin, as Rav Moshe writes in the Tshuva. So there are a number of approaches to dealing with that issue, and as I mentioned at the beginning, and I'm going to repeat again in just a minute or two, the approaches that we're taking will not, on a practical level, always help resolve every issue. And I agree that that's an example of the type of issue where even after you've taken this approach, you have to still consider, because in that case, Chazal seemed to be describing a mitzius, which isn't true, as far as we can tell, with practical halachic implications. So I think what you're saying is correct, that the approach that we're taking tonight will not necessarily help you address that unless you conclude that Chazal were only describing the spiritual aspect and not the scientific aspect, and somehow or another the halachas nikba al yedei zev velo zeh, and that's not at all obvious. So that's an excellent point.
Also, I saw in Chagiga, I was looking at Chagiga.
Mm-hmm.
So I saw in Chagiga, talks about the different heavens.
Mm-hmm.
So it was talks about a few that I thought like you can't really explain it with this approach.
That's a very good question.
Talk about the Malone, that goes around the earth, and that's why the sun disappears and reappears.
Right, the Gemara
talks about the heavens where ice and hail and rain are stored.
Those are really good questions, yeah. So you have to figure it out. You have to think about it. But perhaps what the Maharal would be saying or what others might say about those questions, you have to figure out if those are intended to describe the scientific explanation of what's going on in the heavens and the skies, or perhaps more of a spiritual idea, and they're not necessarily describing it. But that's a very good question. And as I said, this approach, I suppose we're running out of time, so I'll get back to, I guess, my concluding point, which is that this approach, I believe, is very powerful. And as the Rav, who was certainly no intellectual slouch, someone who was not afraid to confront any issue in a non-apologetic way, felt that this issue really does resolve these questions for him. But let's say a person says, this is all nice and fine, but I still have questions. And this approach, like it or not, is not sufficient to answer my questions. Whatever the questions are, person is bothered by archaeological evidence that against the possibility of the Mabul, let's say, as described. So how is one to deal with that? So that, as I mentioned before, one has to examine the strength of the scientific evidence, one has to examine the psukim, and one has to consider the necessary qualifications and rules that allow a person to deviate from the simple or literal understanding of the psukim, and all those are very broad. Let's say, even having done that and considered these matters, they're still left, they're bothered by a question. So, what should they do? So I'd like to share with you a thought from the Ran in Drashos that actually very much relates to this week's Parsha. Perfect opportunity. And this is source 11 on page 4. The Ran asks a question. If you look at the end of Parsha Shmos, the Psukim say, Bayamein Ha'am, Klaisel believed in Moshe and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And yet, after Kriyas Yamsuf, we're going to read this week, Vayaminu Ba'Hashem uVeMoshe Avdo. And the Ran asks, but didn't they already believe? What happened? And the Ran says, absolutely. They did initially believe. Moshe performed miracles. And the miracles in Mitzrayim were no greater than the miracle of Kriyas Yamsuf. A miracle's a miracle. So what changed? The answer, he says, is that there were numerous things over the course of the story of the Exodus that caused the Jewish people's belief in Moshe to be undermined. For example, why does Moshe ask for 3 days? Doesn't that indicate that he's not really a messenger of God? After all, you could understand the ethical legitimacy of asking for 3 days, but Hayad Hashem Tiktzar, if you're really asking to go out in the name of God, and God's going to take you out and deliver you at any cost, so why do you need a maneuver? And then, when Moshe tells the Jewish people, as we just read yesterday, to borrow Kalim. Again, why? Why the need for this deception, for this seemingly petty request? If they wanted the money, let them say, give us the money. You owe it to us. Why ask to borrow it and then lie? There are other aspects. And the Ran, it's such a beautiful explanation. We don't have time to do it. I recommend read this piece. But his answer basically is that all the instances of deception, including the one at the beginning of this week's Parsha, where Bnei Yisrael are told to head back towards Egypt, so that Paro will say, Nevuchim hein bamidbar, are all to serve a single purpose, to get Paro to come to the Yam Suf. So what caused him to go? A, the expectation they would return in 3 days, because that was the request. That's why, Vayugad lemelech Paro, ki varach ha'am. Varach? What do you mean? He was the one that said leave. No! He expected them to return, clearly, as Rashi points out. And then, to increase that, there was the request to borrow the kalim. This motivated people to run after the money that was borrowed. And then the fact that they looked like they were lost. So what was this? The purpose is to bring about Kriyas Yam Suf. Why was Kriyas Yam Suf so important? Because Kriyas Yam Suf, the Mitzrim, brought about their own demise. They willingly, because when they went into the water, entered the sea. And as Yisro says, Ki badavar asher zadu achareha aleihem, that in the very method in which they tried to kill the Jews by throwing them into the water, they were destroyed. And they did it willingly. Evil brings about its own self-destruction. They walked into their death. And that's the result of evil. It was very important, the Ran explains, for Kriyas Yam Suf to end on that way. That's what inspired Yisro. That taught us a lesson for history. And to make sure that happened, Hashem had to do all those deceptions. He says that's even the reason why the wind blew for the day before Kriyas Yam Suf. Why didn't it just happen like it does in Universal Studios? Right? Boom! The sea splits. Why the need for the wind? Why minimize the miracle? Again, to make sure that Paro could, and in fact did, go in. These were Atzos Merachok. HaKadosh Baruch Hu had a plan. Now there's no doubt that God's plan undermined Moshe's credibility. It left the people, the Jews, with questions which they couldn't answer. In fact, the Ran says maybe even Moshe didn't know why God had asked him to ask for 3 days or borrow the kalim. These were questions which they could not have possibly answered. They undermined Moshe's entire message. Vayaminu b'Hashem uv'Moshe avdo, though. After Kriyas Yam Suf, everything made sense. They were able to answer all those questions that they had, which left them so perplexed. The Ran says that there are going to be things, whether they're history, science, and the like, questions that we don't have answers to. And they're not just there to test us. God didn't bury the dinosaur bones to test us if we're going to really believe in him. No. They have a purpose. As the Ran says, Eitzos Merachok. But we might not be in a position to understand their purpose. Klal Yisrael could not have possibly imagined any conceivable reason for the request of 3 days. And there are many things in history, in life, in science, in theology, questions that we can't answer. And that's where faith begins. When you have faith, when you have bitachon, so then you're able to know something with certainty, even if there are certain questions which you can't answer. And that is the lesson of Kriyas Yam Suf, according to the Ran. Now, does that mean that we shouldn't look for answers? If, after all, every time we encounter a problem that we can't resolve, we end up having to say, well, you just have to believe. You have to have faith, so we shouldn't answer. So the final idea I'd like to leave you with is very powerful. Source 12 from the Ramban. The Ramban here is dealing with the problem of evil, a question which has perplexed great minds. The Torah Sa'adam, the Shah HaGmor. And the Ramban says concerning evil that perhaps in the end of the day we're going to have to say at certain times we don't know. We have to have trust. So maybe we shouldn't even try to solve the problem. We shouldn't study the matter. Which of course is not the Ramban's perspective. He writes a whole book on the topic. And he writes, Vim tishal aleinu kevan sheyesh inyan ne'alam b'mishpat v'nitzarech l'hamin b'tzidko mitzad shofet ha'emes yisparach v'yisala. We're going to have to, in the end of the day, said God is just, and we don't understand why this happened. Lama tatriach osanu v'titzav aleinu lomod atayno shepirashnu v'asod sheramaznu. What are you writing this whole long book for? You're just going to have to believe in the end. So lo nashlich hakol al asmach shenase basof she'ein lefanav lo avla v'lo shikcha ela shekol dvar b'mishpat. And his answer is zu taina saksilim moase chachma. This is a question that only people that hate wisdom would ask. And he doesn't need to say anymore. So yes, ask questions. Yes, look for resolutions. And even if it's true that perhaps, in the end of the day, you might have to say, Tzarechian, that doesn't mean that you shouldn't start. And you never know what you'll find. Thank you very much. There's not enough to mingle because you're going to say that we don't know what a 7 minute month is.
But there could be theoretically,
but practically,
we don't presume.